Season three, Ray.
Season three, we're delivering on our promise.
That we came back from our hiatus.
Yeah, we took the Sparkle season to recover and regroup, get some new idioms, and get primed for season three.
I'll tell you what, I needed that Sparkle season hiatus.
Yeah, same. It was nice.
I bought a toilet, did I tell you?
I heard you made a trip, right?
Made a trip to buy an old toilet, yeah.
Nice.
That was fun.
Sounds like a good time.
It was.
That's good. I'm glad.
And rejuvenating somewhat, I guess, apparently.
That's what it's for, right? To re-energize your life.
Yeah, reconnoiter your thoughts. Have we done reconnoiter? Is that word?
No.
What the hell is that word?
Reconnoiter?
Yeah. Is that also military?
Possibly. We have to add it to our list.
Yeah, reconnoiter.
And if our listeners have any idioms they'd like to add to our list, we would love that for season three for sure.
Oh yeah,
some listener suggestion episodes maybe, or whatever. If you'd like to write in and let us know some that you've been thinking about, like reconnoiter or something else. Yeah,
but we do need input from you. We certainly would love it.
Could use it.
We might say your name on air.
Probably.
Anything could happen
on air.
Yeah, figurative.
Yeah.
Pod air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to kick us off for season three?
I certainly wouldn't hate that, if you don't mind.
No, I
season
don't mind.
Season three kickoff. We don't have a topic.
No, we're starting out strong.
Yeah.
With season three, we don't want to raise the bar too high. We do idioms. There's a bunch of different idioms. This one doesn't have an umbrella. Welcome back.
Welcome back. Your dreams were your ticket out.
Boosh. Season three kickoff.
Yeah. So, and kicking it off, indeed, I have a strange one. Harlequin.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Nice. Harlequin. I don't want to spoil anything.
No. Or the party, so I'll go.
Season three.
Season three. So, Harlequin, am I confusing that? They write the romance novels.
They are referred to as Harlequin romance novels, I believe.
Yeah.
Yes, right.
That's odd, isn't it?
I always, again, I don't want to spoil anything, but if you're asking me what I think of, first I think of a general clown.
Yeah.
And secondly, I think of Harley Quinn, the DC villainess.
Sure.
DC Comics villainess.
Yeah, and I had to take in some of her
nice
antics.
Batman the Animated Series was the birth of her character. Bruce Timm and Paul Dini. Am I spoiling what you're going to offer? I'm sorry.
No, not at all.
Okay.
In fact, quite the opposite, you know?
Nice, I'm filling you in.
Yeah. It seemed for me to do due diligence involved me exploring some of her, but I found hard times in drawing correlations to the true origins. So I'm not exactly sure what some modern evolutions of how that name is used have to do with the origins exactly. Maybe you'll see some dots to connect for us at the end of this.
I'm looking forward to it.
a mute character in traditional pantomime, typically masked and dressed in a diamond-patterned costume.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah, it says here.
Yeah.
Zany. Now, this comes into play also, but is historical. A stock comic character in Italian commedia dell'arte.
Okay. Yeah, that does sound familiar. Like I've looked at something else in the commedia dell'arte. Okay. Yeah. Nice. So just like a stock character they would have in a play, this is the Harlequin character.
This is what it evolved into.
Okay.
That is.
Yeah.
This is. That first sort of incarnation of a masked, hooded character, let's say it that, which appeared in the 13th century sort of as a devil, was in French plays. Here again, first seen on stage 1262.
Hmm.
Yeah. The idea of this sort of character that's sort of transitioned from being a mythical jester in some ways, or magical, from French, 11th century, 12th century, evolved through into German, medieval, and then a little further on, it shows up in Dante's Inferno, is really this character called Alecchino, which is pretty much this Harlequin person. So, and that happened apparently because the church became more and more opposed to this story of magic and myth. And so it was demonized more. Mm. And it was okay then to be devilish and a demon. And at that time, then to portray this character on stage, actors took to wearing masks to fully feel like they could affect a devilish, evil sort of character within that. And that's what it was then at that time. And we're still, talking 15th century.
Mm-hmm.
As that evolved, it gently, through the centuries, came back into a more jester-like persona as it was okay.
From like a devilish way?
Yeah, back from, so, it sort of came a little bit full circle.
Mm-hmm.
In that way. But, you dig and you dig and you dig, but the reality is it really comes from a very old Nordic story. And beyond that, you can't really tell.
Yeah.
But you're talking, the 900s, what do you call that? 10th century? I never have said 10th century.
Mm-hmm.
If we call it the 10th century?
I guess.
Yeah, it just seems, it sounds weird.
In the 900s.
That's why I said 900s.
Yeah, no, it does sound better.
I've heard, anyway. I mean, here's the story. Now, who made this story up? We don't know. But this is where it all comes from. Are you familiar with this story?
I don't know. I'm not sure if I know any 900 stories. Beowulf?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you one.
All right.
So, there's this king, Hurla. King Hurla.
Okay.
That's the king's name.
Hurla.
Hurla.
All right.
And I guess, he's a fairly popular king, and he has a large mead hall, which I guess is one of the big, where those people are always feasting on big beasts.
Yeah, shanks of things.
Yeah, shanks.
And giant
creature shanks.
Yeah, and goblets or whatever you'd call them. Steins, I guess.
Yeah, it looks like a fun time, but you really don't want to be there. You think, man, these guys, they're ready for a fight. But, and they have like knives and stuff.
Boisterous.
Yeah, boisterous, but maybe it's fun. And,
warm beer.
Yeah, mead.
Beer, right, warm mead.
So one time this King Hurla, he's having a party there and, feast, whatever. And this little, elfin king shows up and he's got an air about him, which is a little odd.
Yeah.
But the king's like, cool, well, who are you? Have a seat and chow down with us.
Join our party.
And the little dude says, that's great, let's do it. And he stays a few days and eats and drinks, and they have games and whatever they do. And when the elfin king is about to leave, he tells King Hurla, he says, I'll be back in a year, and that will be for your wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year after that, you'll come to my wedding. And the king was like, well, I have no plans on getting married, dude, but if I ever do, you're welcome. I really enjoyed you.
Nice. All right.
So the little king goes away, and some stuff happens. Some people bring the king their daughter and their some other royalty or something. So they fix up that he's going to marry this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so the king's like, wow. I guess that little dude had some insight.
He knew what's up.
And sure enough, on the wedding day, little dude shows up.
Nice.
And they party for several days. They have a hooting old time. Whatever they did back then.
Yeah.
And the elfin king, he leaves and he says, all right, I'll see you in a year when I get married.
Yeah.
So he does. And so King Hurla, in a year, rides off to Elfin Dude's place with a whole troop of his people on horses.
Yeah.
And they're going to spend some time over there.
We're here for the party, yeah.
Here for the party.
Yeah.
And they do, and they find him, and they stay, and they have a great time. And when they're going to leave, this Elfin King, he says, look, now, when you're going back to your place, stay on your horse, and I'm going to give you this greyhound dog, and this dog's going to sit up on your lap with you on the horse, and don't get off of your horse until this dog jumps down off of your lap onto the ground.
All right.
So King Hurla's like, oh, that's weird, but all right.
Right so far. You know, just go with it, I guess.
How's he pee? You know, I don't know.
Right.
Can I pee?
Dog, I gotta pee, though. Can you just get off?
Yeah, jump down.
Don't you have to pee, dog?
Yeah, dog doesn't have to pee. Oh, he also gives them a bunch of these, he gives them a bunch of weapons, swords and stuff, and he gives them a pack of hunting hounds to go with him.
Okay.
So he says, you know, you might need to hunt on your way back or whatever. Be safe. Here's a bunch of stuff for you.
Seems thoughtful.
I guess for in the time. I don't know what rich king type people did, but.
We'll send you with supplies. That's nice.
Yeah, send you off with supplies.
Yeah.
Now you just get like a Tupperware with some macaroni or something.
Yeah, there's some stuff in there.
Yeah.
Salad.
So they troop off.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going for a long time, and they can't find King Hurla's meat hall. They can't find their way back. And eventually, they're tired. They've been going a long time, and they find this little farmhouse. So they stride up on their horses to the farmhouse, to this farmer, and say, hey, man, we're looking for King Hurla's meat hall. And the farmer says, oh, well, there's tell of a meat hall that was once a King Hurla or something up over that hill there, but it's just a myth. Like, there's nothing much left of the castle and the hall. The story is that the king left 200 years ago to go on a party and never came back.
Nice.
And they're like, what the hell is this? So it makes one of the dudes jump off his horse because he wants to like go after the farmer for, you know, mocking them or whatever.
Yeah.
And as soon as his feet hit the ground, he bursts into ashes. He turns into ashes. So this is the story, whatever legend or fun little story that was told in the 900s, 10th century, is that now King Hurla and his hounds and this mythical troop on horses with a dog on the horse roam the countryside hunting and searching for home. And if you see them and get caught up in them, they will pull you in and make you one of them or kill you or any number of things. So it was one of these scary sort of medieval stories that was around from then on. And then naturally, as people do, and he was King Hurla, the Hurla King, and that evolved into this character that they lightened up a bit for a little while there, turned him into a jester. Then it was more demonized by the church, so he was even more demonic, not wanted by the church for him to be a desirable, fun, or approachable character, since it was a myth, and that's anti-church. And then now back to full circle to where we are, somehow it's this woman who contorts and kicks people's butt. So I don't know how it made its way all the way to that. And in my research, it clearly states that the vast, vast majority who are a fan of that character have no idea of the true history of the name.
No.
And what it's based on at all, or that it was even a name before her as a character.
I didn't know that it was a mythical king from long ago. I just assumed it kind of always went back to jester, and it was that like checkered diamond pattern.
Right.
Yeah.
So as it was softened up there then in the 13th century, 12th century, 13th, it became that. Yeah, but the true story is the one I dictated.
It's that cursed king.
And beyond that, I mean, it's a fun story.
Why is he cursed, though? Yeah, it seems like a fun story, but then he's cursed.
But he's trapped in time, right? So this elfin king knew he was luring him out of his whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's like an astral. And in research, you'll find a lot of, how do you say, people who enjoy the occult and mythology and wear robe-like attire. It's, they have a lot of candles and gothic sort of accoutrement.
No, sure. We're a superstitious race.
These are the people that enjoy the story of King Hurla.
Huh. That is cool, though. I mean, it sets up a lot of other storylines. Like, you see that myth play out in different areas. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. That's Norse, did you say? Like 900, where
yeah.
are we? Okay, so we're Vikings.
I suppose so.
That's cool. That's awesome. Those legends. Yeah. I see that story reflects in a lot of things.
Right? And,
yeah.
And I mean, maybe it came from older than that, and there's just no papyrus around to tell us.
Right. The records from that area are spotty at best.
Yeah. But that's the oldest it traces, and I kind of enjoyed that.
Nice. That is cool.
So, King Hurla, Harlequin, what do you have?
I have priming the pump. Priming the pump. It would have been a good lead-in off of our intro.
Priming?
We were talking about prime. I mean, I was.
Oh, gonna, you mean for us
for
to
us
have
today, right now.
Like, wanting cause, more.
Because we're priming the pump for season three.
We are.
You know, like that kind of thing. Priming is what I said.
And we ask to have.
Right.
Our friends out there help us to prime.
Yeah, exactly. You would help us prime our pump. Okay. Moving on.
Yeah.
In a general sense, it means to get something going. To get something going that's not going right now.
Right now, it isn't going.
Right.
But if you would just do this.
Yeah, we can get it going.
We could get it going.
And I feel like the idiomatic sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is where I spent my research, is more in relation to economics versus...
Economics.
Yes. The idiom phrase. Although it gains its traction in our language through economics, I guess. The idiom sense, not the actual literal sense.
Define?
Priming the pump is, I'll just go ahead, is a Keynesian economic theory named after John Maynard Keynes, which states that government intervention within the economy aimed at increasing aggregate demand can result in a positive shift within the economy. Based on the cyclical nature of money within an economy in which one person's spending directly relates to another person's earnings, and that increase in earnings leads to subsequent increases in spending.
Like, for example,
yeah,
I have a car with a carburetor,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes you can't get it to start, and you got to get a little bit of gasoline,
right,
in like a bottle cap,
right,
and then I hold the carburetor open, I pour this gasoline,
yeah.
into the carburetor.
Yes.
It's dangerous. You pour too much, you get a big flame shoots out at you.
Sure.
But then that starts the car.
Mm-hmm.
Gives it enough to fire that and get the pistons going. And then that draws it up the gas that's just not making it. So that's priming it.
Mm-hmm.
Prime the engine.
Right.
So that for that first spending feels like that cap full of gasoline.
Yeah. Exactly.
That was my question.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That is what it is. We'll go straight forward. Priming a pump in a literal sense is that there, if you picture like a general water wheel with some water at the bottom, once you prime the pump, you throw some water in the top of it, and then it starts the wheel to spin, and once the wheel starts to spin, it picks up that water at the bottom.
Yes.
And then becomes self-sustaining.
Yes.
But it's stagnant until you get that little bit of water to get that wheel just to spin a little bit. And once that wheel kicks on, then the water pumps itself. It keeps the wheel going itself.
Yes.
Is the idea, is how priming a pump literally works.
Literally.
Yeah, exactly.
So it starts the spin.
It starts the spin, exactly. Then the amount of, we'll say, fluid that's already inside of the pump can take over and continue its own spin.
Yeah, it gets it into a more perpetual activity.
Yeah. 1916, Everybody's Magazine. When the waters of business are stagnant, gentlemen, it becomes necessary, if I may say so, to prime the pump. Wall Street Journal, 1933. To carry the pump priming analogy a step further, it is suggested that a small portion of the expected flow of restored industrial income be directed to the reservoir from which the original prime was borrowed.
So you got to pay it back.
Well, this is a different... I think they're using it... I don't think they're saying pay it back in this one. I think they're referring to the fluid in the pump already as being borrowed. I'm reading it again.
You borrowed it to prime it, and it sounded like it was like, now put it back, that you've got more coming.
It does sound like that, kind of.
That's what it felt like.
But this idea of prime being used to mean to fill or charge or load kind of goes back even further to like the 1500s. When we were first getting our pumps together.
Yeah, we first got a handle on this pumping situation.
Yeah, we first got this pumping thing. But the modern day phrase, it seems to have originated from this idea of President Herbert Hoover created a Reconstruction Finance Corporation, RFC, in 1932, which was kind of created to make loans to banks and small businesses or large businesses. Then in 1933, Franklin Roosevelt felt that the pump priming would be the only way really for the economy to recover from the Great Depression.
Right.
So through this Reconstruction Finance Corporation that Herbert Hoover created and other public works things, I mean, he spent billions of dollars to prime the pump of our economy, essentially, and stirred that growth like really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it provided financial support to state and local governments, made loans to banks, railroads, mortgage associations, and other businesses. And its just purpose was to boost the country's confidence and help banks kind of resume day-to-day function. My money's not here.
It's in Joe's house.
In Bill's house. Hey, what's my money doing in your house, Frank?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, and it worked really well. You stimulate the economy, you know, by the government giving it some money and doing some whatever it may be, social programs, infrastructure, giving people jobs like that.
All of it. I mean, he invested heavily in social everything. Yeah.
And then that stimulates private sector investment and mm-hmm. other growth and boom, it's like a fire in a tinder shack, whatever those are.
Well, that's the idea. The pump then continues to spin itself through after you've primed it, you've got it going. Now it's you know, seemingly self-sustaining.
Yeah.
In a way. And then people steal that water out and have to start fresh again. Yeah, the RFC, it was cool. They became sort of more prominent under the New Deal, like I said, with Roosevelt. But it did operate through World War II. It sort of shifted its focus and loaned more towards smaller banks, state chartered banks that weren't a part of the Federal Reserve System, that weren't insured, things like that.
Yeah.
To help those areas, same thing, just kind of build back out. And it's. I also found that a distinction in the RFC, they could make loans on the basis of collateral, which the Federal Reserve and other lenders would not accept at the time. I believe that's different nowadays. But yeah, priming the pump is a literal thing, as we talked about. A little bit of fluid in there gets the turbine spinning, then the turbine has enough to move its own fluid inside of itself. And off to the races. That's all we do here in this place, is we spin turbines forever. We haven't learned a better way to do anything besides spin a turbine.
I mean, it's a hell of a way to
We've
do stuff.
We've been doing this since King Haile.
What's Hurla.
Hurla, since King Hurla.
The Hurla King. No,
not quite that long, but
right.
But not far after. We were like, you know what? This is good enough.
I mean, you know, we had a creek going by with some gusto.
Yeah.
Brook.
Yeah.
What have you.
Sure.
And then you made that paddle wheel.
Yeah. Great.
And the damn creek spins the wheel.
It's a great idea.
And then now I can make that wheel do other things.
Sure. I mean,
transfer that energy with some sort of belt that I fashion out of wheat wrappings, bamboo straps,
jute or hemp.
Yeah, jute and hemp.
Yeah,
that's what I was really looking for.
Yeah.
Then you've got it going on.
Again, that sure for you know pre-industrialized civilization, you have got it going on. But we're at a place where we can capture photons directly from the sun. We should put more into that, and maybe not the spinning turbine thing. Is all I'm saying.
I wonder if the sun could spin a turbine.
That's the thing. That's what we do. We use it to boil water to spin a turbine.
Hey, something works for us. I stick with it.
Seriously.
So that is priming the pump.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. So yeah, I'm gonna regale you a bit.
Oh, all right.
Have you heard this term? And we have a restaurant here in Pittsburgh with this name, in fact. And it's probably not unique. There are probably restaurants in other American towns that have this word as their name. The Gandy Dancer.
I only know it as the restaurant. I have no idea. I thought it was the name of the restaurant.
Well, you'll take
note. It is.
That the Gandy Dancer restaurant is in the PNLERR building.
Yes.
On the other side of our oldest bridge in town, the Smithfield Street Bridge.
So noted.
And the Pennsylvania and Lake Erie Railroad building. PNLERR.
Yes. No, it does say PNLERR on it.
Yeah. Pennsylvania and Lake Erie Railroad. So the Gandy Dancer is in a railroad building. Yes. Yeah.
It's and, pretty.
Yeah. And I always heard tell, being, you know, Pittsburgher, listening to stories that people hear tell of, that it had something to do with people working on the railroad. I always thought it was, I guess it's called a switchman, signalman. I always thought it had something to do with the, the guy with the lantern out there, I guess, was a signalman.
He's Gandy dancing.
This is, I mean, what I assumed. I never really looked into it.
Yeah.
So the Brits don't have this term, although they had the need for the same service that our Gandy Dancer provided.
What service is that?
Well, I'm going to get to you.
All right.
But they didn't call it the Gandy Dancer.
What did they call it?
We're not going over there.
Okay.
You know, I'm just going to cut to it because it's season three.
Season three. Just keep shouting that out all season.
Yeah. So here's the thing.
Yeah.
The tracks, you know, you and I, we don't think much about it. If you're not a railroad buff, what are you thinking about?
I'm not. Yeah.
You're like, it's a railroad tracks, a train, the wheels fit in there, I guess. That's great.
Yeah. I appreciate that they work.
Yeah.
And I love high speed rail. So yeah. But I don't think about them.
But here's something that you might not have known.
Yeah, probably.
You know, I don't know what else in the world is quite like this. The phenomenon of nature that maybe isn't that important to us now in our modern iPhone society. But at a time, a phenomenon of nature, just like there are no straight lines, you know? But that's but I digress.
In nature?
Yeah.
Sure.
But
it's fractals.
Fractals. So, the male goose, this is crazy, really.
Yeah.
Adult male geese.
Yeah.
Are all, did you know this?
Yeah.
They're all the same size.
Oh, no. I thought you were going to call them, they're all called.
They're what?
I did not know that, no. I thought you were going to say they're called ganders.
They are called ganders.
But I did not know that they were all the same size.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
The gander part was coming.
Right. That's so what I felt. No, I did not. They're all, wow.
Yeah. Huh. So in fact, their wingspan is what the inside, if you touch one inner rail and another inner rail, their wingspan fits that.
Who's doing this study? What?
Well, I mean, like I said, people didn't have everything we have now then. You know, like, so you had what you had.
Round up all these male goose and let's see how their wingspans measure.
And you had ganders. So you'd have a gander.
Does it fit here?
Does he fit here? And he'd walk down the track.
Yeah.
Inside.
What?
With the goose.
Don't. This can't be something that's happening, right? Don't.
Correct. Okay. I am losing you.
Oh, come on. Wait.
Right.
You had me.
Yeah, I did.
You were so close.
I know.
You flew too close to the sun.
I fell apart.
It was
like a wax wing goose. So yeah.
I would have kept on going for a little bit longer.
This was a lie.
He's doing the study.
So what else did they have to do?
You know, people are just hanging out with a bunch of goose. I don't know.
I mean, geese. You would just try stuff. How about the stick rosewood tree.
I mean, we've all been,
try that.
Sure.
Nope, that's not doing it.
All these geese are the same size.
Yeah. That seemed crazy, right? But you have things in nature like quartz, you know? So, I mean...
reality is fascinating.
Yeah.
Every day it fascinates me more.
I figured I could sell it.
It was close. I was there.
I didn't do enough work on my fiction. So, no, the reality is this. This is the true reality. It took me a little digging to understand it. You know, it's described to you, but even when they describe it, it doesn't sink in, at least to me. So a guy has a pole,
mm-hmm.
and at the end of the pole, it's almost like a reverse hockey stick. Like it bends, but it's flat in the way that the wide part is horizontal, not vertical. You know what mm-hmm. I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it curves and bends flat at the end, like a shovel almost, but it's just a little piece of metal. At the edge of that, the very edge of that bent piece, it's sharp. So you stick it under the rail on the railroad, and you sort of use the sharp piece to rock it back and forth and dig into that gravel bed that the tracks sit on, ballast. And you get nice under there, and then you make a prying motion sort of back and forth that's more up and down. You make an up and down prying motion after you got it dug in.
Mm-hmm.
And it still didn't register to me until I watched a video, because there are a lot of unnecessary postulations about what this could or couldn't be. Knowing that, okay, you know, in the building the railroad out west, there were a lot of Chinese and Mexican and even Native American workers.
Mm-hmm. Workers.
Yeah, working on that. Yeah. They did work.
Sure, they were working, yes.
Yeah. You know how we were.
Yeah.
And that goes back to that magazine, but I digress on that. Yeah, but in the Midwest, these workers were Eastern Europeans and Italians.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the Northern United States... they were largely African American.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing to it where people would speculate about how these guys moved and how that was a dance. But until you see it,
mm-hmm.
it just doesn't, you just don't digest it. So what it really is a large group of them, a line of them with their own tool, this tool I mm-hmm. described.
Same. Yeah. Okay.
And if you can picture a line of them, maybe 20 of them are standing on the tracks facing, digging at the inside of one rail mm-hmm. all together. And then behind them, facing their back, so they're all facing the same way, mm-hmm. another line of guys is digging at the rail that's behind them from the outside of the rail. And they dig under the ballast gravel, and they shuck it up and down a few times, and then on a signal they all hoist together like a rowing company, and it moves the entire set of tracks, because the tracks get out of a line
mm-hmm.
sitting on the gravel, and the weight of trains going over it, they get twisty
mm-hmm.
and they get so twisty that they, twisty is the actual technical definition, they get so twisty you could derail the train, so you got to go out there and straighten the tracks. So these guys would do this to move, they move like entire pieces of track. It's fascinating to see it happen.
Yeah.
And so not unlike what you allude to, let's say in you see chain gangs and prison workers,
mm-hmm.
We'll be busting rocks or something, but they'd sing songs to keep in rhythm with each other, you know, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing makes the grueling work somewhat more pleasurable, and also loans itself to a rhythm that helps the work.
Yeah,
and these guys have the same thing. They have a little chant or a little song.
Mm-hmm.
That forms a rhythm.
Yeah.
So that they jimmy their things under there all at once, and they move them the same, and then they all hoist together on this one sort of part of the rhythm. and it picks up the tracks and moves them. So, but why Gandhi Dancer? You might say, you go, I could see the dance maybe, but what the hell? Is that goose thing Jay was talking about real after all? But no.
No. I'm not biting. You tell me.
And why did they have this in England, but they didn't, they had this need in England, but they didn't have a Gandhi Dancer?
Mm-hmm.
This was because the tool was manufactured by the Gandhi Manufacturing Company. This is true.
No, I believe you. I do believe you. This, yeah.
This is the Gandhi.
Yeah, right.
Hey, give me that Gandhi.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Dancer, they weren't, it's not really a dance, but it's alliteration like we always discover, right? So Gandhi Dance.
Yeah, the D, D to D.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's nice.
That is nice.
And this is the Gandhi Dancer.
So it just said Gandhi on the tool, but what do you know what the tool is called? Do they call it a Gandhi as well?
A line, man, yeah, hang on.
No, a line, okay. I was wondering.
Lining bar.
Lining
Gandhi
bar.
Gandhi lining bar.
Nice, okay. You were explaining it earlier on, and I was wondering why, but now I see why. So they could actually move and unwarp the lines or whatever, or their tracks.
That's yeah. Cool.
I didn't know if it was like to replace stuff underneath or what. Yeah, nice, all right.
No, huh. Just to put them back in line.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Nice.
That's what I'm trying to say to you. So Gandhi Dancer.
Nice.
It's more than just a restaurant.
More than just that restaurant.
In the railroad building.
It is a restaurant, not just a bar, right?
Oh, it's very much a restaurant. Okay, yeah. What have you?
I have a term that we know around this city, Jolly Roger.
Jolly Roger.
Not that we're the only ones that know what a Jolly Roger is.
Right, yeah, it's the Buccaneer thing, right?
Pirate flag.
Yeah.
Which our home baseball team is called the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Right, but the Jolly Roger comes up.
Raise the Jolly Roger.
Yeah.
That's what they say when and if we win a game, I think.
This is true.
I'm not sure how frequently that happens.
But I mean, not quite half the time.
Right. We had a winning season a few years ago. Where we finished over 500.
A little bit over half the time. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway.
Did we threaten to get into the World Series?
No.
No.
I think that's been a while. But I don't know. I don't follow the baseball.
You'd know about it. You'd hear rumblings.
If we made it, no, we would. Of course we would know. Yeah.
Yeah.
1724, Charles Johnson, General History of Pirates, a general history of robberies and murders of the most notorious pirates and also their policies, discipline, and government. Just a rich, full title.
That's a whole face of a book.
Says, on hoisting of the Jolly Roger, the name they give their black flag, their French hearts failed. So Mr. Johnson is just saying a black flag in general. When they, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
He goes on to further cite two pirates as having named their black flag, specifically black flag, Jolly Roger. Bartholomew Roberts, June 1721, and Francis Spriggs, December 1723. He says, while Spriggs and Roberts used the same name for their flag designs were very different, suggesting that already Jolly Roger was a generic term for a black pirate flag rather than the name of the specific design. Neither Spriggs nor Roberts' Jolly Roger consisted of the classic, which I will go into, which I probably should have said before, the classic Jolly Roger, which we know of and probably think of today, at least in Pittsburgh, is just the skull with two crossbones underneath of it, right? If someone said, draw Jolly Roger, you might draw that.
But I would draw him on a pennant-shaped flag, right?
Pendant-shaped flag?
Pennant.
A triangle?
Yeah.
I guess that would be ours here. But not specifically.
No.
They were more flag-shaped, raggedy flag-shaped, but still flag-shaped. Still rectangular.
Yeah.
Richard Hawkins, who was captured by pirates in 1724, reported that the pirates had a black flag bearing the figure of a skeleton stabbing a heart with a spear.
Wow.
Which they named that the Jolly Roger.
That's pretty violent.
And this description resembles a lot of the flags of the golden ages of pirates, as it's them. I looked it up, and there are a lot of pirate flags. They are generally black, and well, they are black, but some of them have, like the one, there's a full-size skeleton stabbing a heart with a spear. I mean, they're crudely depicted, not like, you know, on a flag, obviously, with like felt. But yeah, some of them are bones. Some of them are full bodies with bloody hearts. Some of them are skulls by themselves. Some of them are the classic skulls and crossbones. Some of them have, there's a lot.
Apparently. Is the heart sort of like our sort of played up heart shape, or is it more realistic, a pulpy muscle looking thing with the ventricles?
Crude draw. They're not, you know, anatomical drawings.
I'm just saying, how do you know it's a heart?
I think it's the muscle pumpy looking one. The actual heart, not the Valentine's Day candy. Okay. Sometimes they're on fire. Sometimes they're cool. Sometimes they're not even skeletons. They're just like guys with swords.
Sure.
But the skull and crossbones was perhaps used by Richard Warley in the early 1700s. He was a pirate that was active in the Caribbean.
Richard.
Well, yeah.
All right.
In the East Coast, where else? In the Caribbean and the East Coast of the American colonies during the 18th century. Black Sam Bellamy was an English pirate who operated in the early 18th century, and he is best known as the wealthiest pirate in recorded history.
Wow.
One of the faces of the golden age of piracy, lived to the ripe old age of 28.
Oh, man, that was a rough gig.
Yeah. But why did we settle on the skull and crossbones? Why?
I always picture Blackbeard. Those guys are all clearly in their 40s or 50s.
I mean, it was a tough life at sea.
I mean, Johnny Depp.
That guy, yeah.
He's whatever like, that guy's pirate name is.
Jack Sparrow, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are not necessarily real pirates.
No.
Right. But, yeah, it was it's tough out there. Got all the sorts of, like, marine diseases, exposure. You know, you get supplies. What are you eating out there? Salt cured whatever. Plus, mermaids probably have some kind of fish disease we don't know about.
Yeah, definitely.
And all the sirens that lure you to your death.
Yeah.
The skull and crossbones is also known as the death's head.
Death. Oh, death.
Oh, death.
Delph is singing.
Oh, crap. Season 3. The death's head is a symbol consisting of the human skull and two long bones crossed together under or behind the skull. which this design originated in the late Middle Ages, just as a symbol of death. So nothing new here. The pirates borrowed this artwork from gravestones, you know, previous centuries of gravestones. We've been kind of carving these things in to mean death for a long time. Because when we die, we decompose into skull and just two bones behind the skull.
Apparently, yeah.
How did we get the name Roger? Jolly Roger?
Right, there's that.
In there to mean this?
Because it could have been Richard, that pirate.
Could have been Richard, could have been a Black Sam. Or right, go, exactly. Yeah, nice remembery.
Just a pirate named Richard seems a...
What's your name? Yeah. Richard?
Shouldn't they have like Captain Hook, Blackbeard? You got these names all of a sudden. Hi, I'm Richard, I'm here to rob you. Like, what is that?
Put your stuff in the bag. Yeah. Or my cannons will go off. Yeah, I don't know.
But it's not very intimidating. I don't really want to rob you, but I've got to. You
understand? This is what I've got to do. It's tough out there. Why Roger?
Indeed.
You know, maybe because one of the alternate terms for the devil is Old Roger.
No, it is.
Have you heard this before? Yeah.
No.
Yeah. In present day 18th century slang, which would have been, Roger also means penis. So, yeah.
Well, that's British saying, give you a proper Roger.
The flag could mean happy penis.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, the rogering seems to be devil related, death related in that old Roger Devil sense, but records from that era are spotty at best. The way that they purportedly got to use it in more of a flag sense is the death's head symbol was a common way in captain's notes, travel logs, to note the people who died at sea or wherever. You could just, you know, put a little skull and crossbones next to their name on the ledger when you're keeping your records. They were sewn into old canvas sails and tossed overboard, starring Goldie Hawn. But yeah, this symbol has been around, and we've carved it on tombstones and things like that to denote our own deaths and demise, and the pirates wanting to be intimidating and frightening. And
sure, you see us.
You see a flag of exactly. You see a flag with a menacing skull and stabbing you in the heart. You're like, maybe I'm not gonna go near that boat.
No.
Full power to the engines. Let's get out of here. But really, it was probably just sails.
Yeah, it was the sails.
Yeah, full power to the wind.
If you had wind.
If you had wind.
But you had as much wind as the guy chasing you.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, Jolly Roger.
Jolly Roger.
Possibly old Roger for the devil. Possibly penis.
Or who could say? A savory candy treat. Why isn't that's a Jolly Rancher.
Yeah, that's a Jolly Rancher. Sorry. Different.
Skip that.
Yeah. No, we could keep it.
Yeah.
I like the watermelon flavor the best.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
That's us, our first episode of season 3.
Season 3.
It turns out
we're almost to our 100th episode.
Are we really?
Yes.
How about that?
I need to figure out when that is. Soon, probably.
So yeah, it is it's a great thing, and you should please get in touch with us, like we said at the top of the show, at Whole Nine Yards Pod, which we find us to be on
Twitter, Instagram, and Reddit.
You can do it on all those things, and yep. Whole Nine Yards Podcast, somehow the cast is on there on the Facebooks.
Yeah, or the email coming up.
Email coming up. Rebecca will tell you. And we hope greatly to hear from you.
Yeah. Right? We enjoy another year together.
Another year. Don't say. All right. And then I'm Jay.
And I'm Ray.
And we're not idiots.
Whole Nine Yards is written, recorded, and produced by Big Science Pods. Learn more at wholenineyards.org or contact Whole Nine Yards by emailing ku@wholenineyards.org. That's ku@wholenineyards.org. Whole Nine Yards theme music composed by Big Science Music.